Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Sorry, this one's coming up. Oh, well, I mean, just a day late. Not too bad, actually, really, considering that in the old days I used to do about 12 of these a year. We're on our weekly schedule, trying to keep to that, which is good. At the moment, there's been a few blokes in a row. I will say that. Partly that is because I lost some episodes. Yes, it has happened. It has happened with all my other podcasts. It hadn't happened with Willosophy yet. But now it has. During the comedy festival, I sat down with Kitty Flanagan and Jason Byrne in the same day, and somehow those two episodes have gone missing. And when I say somehow, probably my fault. It's normally my fault at the end of the day. I've tried to take as much of me being involved with this podcast out of the system to avoid things like this. We have Mike Hell, our US producer, who pieces it all together and makes it happen for you guys. And I have podcast Mike, young Mike, who's now producing the podcast, booking guests, helping it come out every week. And look, here's the thing. Mike's going to come around tomorrow when I record a new episode, and he's going to upload it onto his computer as well, because it turns out when you leave a dickhead like me in charge, we need a backup plan. So I firstly want to apologize to Kitty Flanagan and Jason Byrne, who were both so generous to give me their time to do the podcast, but also did such wonderful podcasts. I'm so disappointed that you won't get to hear them. I mean, I got to hear them, so I guess in a purely selfish way, I got to have a wonderful conversation with Kitty Flanagan, and I got to have a wonderful conversation with Jason Byrne that I felt very honored to be part of. Unfortunately, you guys don't get to listen to it. Here's the thing. I reckon Kitty will probably sit down with me again at some stage. And we'll try to do another episode. I'll lure her to the house with the dogs, because Kitty loves dogs, and we talked about that a lot in the podcast that you won't hear, but the dogs weren't here this time. By next time, hopefully I can invite her over and she can hang out with the dogs, and we'll do another podcast. The Jason Byrne one, I've got to say, I'm particularly disappointed in losing, because Jason said at the end of it that no one had really ever interviewed him like that, because Jace, being so hilariously funny and so incredibly entertaining, often when he's doing interviews, people just expect him to be mad, to be wacky. And we had a really deep conversation about, you know, the nature of philosophy, the meaning of life, you know, where he grew up and what was important to him. And yeah, I'm devastated to lose it. It was a wonderful conversation to be part of, and, you know, incredibly grateful that I got to have it with him. And in a way, I feel very privileged that I'm the only person who's had that conversation with him. But I am also devastated that you guys won't get to hear it. Jace obviously lives in another country, but he visits Australia every year or two. So hopefully at another stage, Jason and I will get to sit down and do it again. So I apologize for that. I apologize to them in particular, because both of them gave their time so generously to me. And it is incredibly disappointing that I don't have an episode to share with you guys because of that. Kitty Flanagan is currently on tour right around Australia. So check out her shows wherever you can go and see Kitty Flanagan. She is one of the greatest comedians this country has ever produced. All right, today's episode. Here's what you got to know. James Keogh is the name that we have on this episode. And there was a little bit of a debate around this with podcast Mike and Sam Cav and a few of the people involved in the podcast about whether we would release this episode under his stage name, Vance Joy. He's best known as Vance Joy. That's the name that he performs his music under, Vance Joy. But James Keogh was the man that I sat down and talked to. And James Keogh was how he introduced himself on the podcast. So this podcast is under the name James Keogh, but don't go to jamesKeogh.com. Go to vancejoy.com, vancejoy.com, and find out where James is performing with his band, and go and see him. Just a beautiful musician, a really beautiful guy. I was just rapt that he came over to the house in the middle of an incredibly busy schedule. He had time to squeeze it in, and I loved having this chat with him, getting to know him. We'd met a couple of times before, but we did not know each other very well at all, and I just loved having this chat with him. There was a record company executive sitting in the corner. It's rare that that happens. Normally it's a one-on-one conversation. Maybe podcast Mike will sit in if he's around, but normally it's a one-on-one conversation. This time we had someone in the corner. I don't think it really affected the conversation at all, but I just wanted to let you know that was what was going on. And if you like this podcast, we have a Twitter and a Instagram, and I think a Facebook as well. Podcast Mike is in charge of all those. So come and find us in the places where you find things. Subscribe to the podcast. That means you get a new episode delivered to you every week. And obviously, that's great for us. We're going to look for a sponsor for the podcast at some stage to help pay James Fosdyke, who does the original art for each episode. Well, I mean, we're already paying James and we're already paying Podcast Mike and Mike Howell. But at the moment, that's just coming out of... we have a Patreon, patreon.com/TOFOP, T-O-F-O-P. It's for all the podcasts in the TOFOP little world that we have. Charlie and I have our podcast TOFOP. I have a spin-off called FOFOP. You can find those. They're a bit stupider than this. Basically, Charlie and I have inane and stupid conversations that are occasionally hopefully funny. And if you're going to start listening to TOFOP, I would recommend starting at the new episodes and working your way back. Don't start at the start. It was a long time ago when we started doing the podcast, 8 years or so ago. And look, some of the early episodes are particularly rough and have some subject matter that perhaps we wouldn't discuss if we were doing the podcast today. So start with the new ones and then go back and listen to the old ones if that's what you're going to do. So there is heaps of episodes of Willosophy. We're trying to put out one every single week, which is really exciting. I'm going to sit down with Em Rusciano tomorrow. So I reckon that'll be a really great chat. She's a really interesting person and, you know, like a bunch of really... you know, firmly held and stridently expressed opinions. And I mean that in the nicest of all ways. I'm just very excited that I'm going to sit down with her because I imagine it could go anywhere. And I'm really looking forward to getting to know Em and having a conversation about things that she thinks are important on the podcast. So follow us on Willosophy Pod, wherever you can find us. Support us on Patreon and just share the podcast around. You know, rate it. Promote it, help retweet it or share it on Instagram or any of those sort of things if you enjoy the podcast, because the more you do that, obviously the bigger our reach is and the more opportunity we have to, you know, attract a sponsor to the podcast. And if we can attract a sponsor to the podcast, then you're going to be guaranteed that you can hear this podcast every week. So that's basically how it goes. I mean, it's pretty simple, really. If the podcast is going well and we can bring in enough money to just make sure that everybody gets paid, then it's going to come out weekly for as long as we can possibly do it. And I'm going to, you know, talk to a whole range of really interesting people, hopefully over the next year or so. So that's all you really need to know. Again, vancejoy.com is the place where you can find James's stuff and find out where he's performing and, you know, go and see him do a show, support him. And if you like this episode, tweet him about it and let him know that you enjoyed this episode and share the love around. I still have some shows to do. My Will Legal Tour, which is my favorite show that I've ever done in my entire life. In fact, I'm now at the point that I'm enjoying it so much that I'm terrified about what I'll do next year. It's all about me getting arrested on the way to Wagga Wagga, and I feel like to do a sequel to it, I'm going to have to get arrested again for something worse. So come and see this show before I get locked up. That's probably the advice I'm giving to you. So I'm off to Canberra first. I'm doing my first big show in Canberra for a very long time. I normally go to Canberra and do the work in progress shows, work up my new tour. But I'd been promising Canberra audiences for a while that I would come back with a fully formed show. And so you get to see this show right at the peak of me enjoying doing it. And I think it's at its best at the moment. So Canberra and then Sydney after that. I'm hoping there'll be some overseas shows and some more Australian shows and a whole bunch of other things, because I'm not done with this show yet and I'm really enjoying doing it and I actually think there's some more growth left in it. Hopefully not some more actual time growth, because it took 90 minutes the other night in person. That feels like it might be a tad too long, so I might have to edit a few things, cut it down a little along the journey. But come out and see a show. That'd be absolutely fantastic. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. All right, there you go. I've just got to stop talking. Here's James Keogh. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the podcast starts. I ask our guest who they are and then they answer. So this is that bit. Who are you?
I am James Keogh, and I perform music under the name Vance Joy.
I'm always fascinated. You're not the first person who I've had on the podcast who has an alter ego, you know, performs under a different name to the the name that they have in real life. And I'm always interested in how those people answer that question, because yes. It is Where did, I mean, I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but just to set the agenda.
Yes.
Where did the idea of differentiating, you know, your name, your real life name from your performing name come from? Why did you think that was a thing that you wanted to do?
The first reason, or the first, I guess one of the motivations was I was playing open mic nights in Melbourne, and the first one I ever did was at a bar called the Great Britain.
Oh yeah.
And they had a great open mic night. It might have been, say, Monday night, and I arrived in, it was in 2010, and I did put my name down on the sheet where you kind of write down your name among, you know, a bunch of names, and you get to play three songs, and I put myself down as James Keogh, and even when the guy was reading my name out, he's like, now James Keogh. And I'm like, And I was like, this, even if that was the way you said it, it just doesn't sound good. And so I was like, okay. And so people mispronounce it a lot. And, you know, that was one example. There was that kind of feeling like I wanted to have something that was more, like, I guess, more memorable and easier to pronounce. But also, I guess it's like that thing. It's like not a convincing reason, like, but it was, everyone else was doing it. And I went to school with a guy named Nick Murphy, and he started performing under the name Chet Faker. And so I was like, oh, that's what you got to do. You got to, if you want to do good. He was doing really well. So, and he had a different name. So I was like, I got to think of a different name. Obviously, that's how it works. And his career was like blossoming and kind of at least launching like a full year before I even did anything. And so I could see that happening, like for a whole year I could hear him on the radio and like see that it was doing really well. And so I had that clear evidence that that's what you had to do. And yeah, I think, I just was reading a book, the book Bliss by Peter Carey, and I saw the name Vance Joy about 20 pages in, and I thought, it's a cool name. It's, you know, and I remember I mentioned it to my girlfriend at the time, and she was like, nah, it's no good. and I had a bunch of names in other ideas, like band idea, like names in my phone. And it's funny because like when you road test things like that with other people, it's crazy the amount of like just the negativity you might get, or even just like the strong opinions. Like it's like, oh, Vance Joy. And it's like a whole car of people would be like, no, that sucks. It's like, you know, it's like, and you're like, oh, I don't know. Like I thought it was good. And it's funny, like until you have, you know, at least even a little thing to show for yourself, it's like, it's hard to kind of stand by that and feel confident about changing your name to something.
Was there at the start and is there now a difference between James and Vance? Like, is there a freedom in, you know, kind of establishing a new identity, an identity that isn't everything that is you?
Maybe I would have a different perspective if it was James Keogh or James Keogh. you know, like if people were like, oh, it's James Keogh. Hey, are you James Keogh from, you know, thing? And maybe I would think, oh, wow, all my identity is tied up in now. It's like there's no, you know, it's just like I don't have a little safe place, which is a private zone. But I feel like there's no real difference between like Vance Joy and, you know, me, especially like, I guess sometimes I'll, you know, in a, say if I'd play a very intimate show for like 30 people at a radio, you know, for like a radio station, or even if it's just like our own show that we put on, as like a special secret show. If I look at footage, like, you know, I looked at a video of me talking in between songs and I was like, man, like you are going on a tangent. Like people who weren't there would just have no idea. Like I felt like, oh wow, I was really like being myself.
Yeah.
And I was like, I wonder how well me being me translates to like a lot of people. Because I think you get little snippets of like who I am, but I speak like, say, like one sentence between each song at a show and maybe like an extended story. But it's a story that I've probably told a lot of times, and it's, you know, it's kind of like a little bit like, you know, it's not completely me. Like it's, you know, it's, I'm choosing a story that I think will appeal broadly.
Right. So, in between this song and this song, we do this bit.
Yeah. We tell the story with some tweaks, but yeah, it's like, and the band is just like, yeah, we know this one, mate.
Tell your little story. I've got to go to the toilet.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Jono the bass player is like eating like a second dinner while I'm playing the solo song in the middle of the set. And he's like got his in-ears in. He's like, is he going to tell the story? Because if he tells the story, then I can definitely have this like, you know, lasagna. But if he doesn't tell the story, I have to get back out there. So it's like, the show is pretty, you know, very like, it's pretty like organized. And every time there is a deviation, the band will be like, oh, that was good when you said that like one word differently. And I was like, it's all it takes to like make it fresh. But
it's really interesting to me. Before we jump into the philosophy thing, I just want to spend a little bit of time with this idea of, it not being your own name, you know, because I'm someone who performs, you know, obviously under my own name.
Yeah.
But you know, the Will Anderson who tells those stories on stage is just a version of who I am as a person. Mm. So sometimes, you know, there becomes a bit of an awkwardness in people not being able to understand the differentiation or myself not being able to understand, yeah, which one that I'm being at different times. And I just wonder if, for example, do people call you, like if they see you at the shops and they recognize who you are, I assume they say to you, Vance Joy, right?
Yeah.
And that's fine, right?
That's fine, yeah.
Yeah. You're just like, you don't feel any need to go, no, I'm Vance Joy, that's fine. I don't need to tell you that I have another name or anything like that. I can still be Vance Joy at the shops.
Yeah, I'm Vance Joy at the shops. And in all kind of random encounters when someone is like recognizing me as Vance Joy. And I think I like this in terms of like the anonymity of like James, I like that, you know, it's like, for example, like if I go to a cafe and they don't know who I am, I like the idea of not getting any preferential treatment or even not even that it's like they give me, I won't get a free coffee, but it's like even just being like, oh, hey, and then like maybe a photo at the end or whatever it is. I like not having any of that kind of pressure.
Well, if you're at a coffee place where they have to say your name, if they said Vance, everybody's going to look in that direction. But you know, James, you can slip by, get your coffee, get out of there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I like that when it's like, you know, even like say you're getting a haircut and it's like the hairdresser doesn't know that you play music. And I guess if it was James Keogh, I was like, oh, is that James Keogh from the song that I recognize or something? And immediately I'd be recognized. And it's not that I don't want to be recognized. It's just like, it's kind of nice just like, I guess, yeah, not having to, it's almost like a bit of pressure. It's like, oh, you do music. It's like, oh, I have to talk about music. And it's like, they might not, and it's in a good way that person will be presenting a great version of themselves. Like they'll be kind and they'll be even more interested in me. But it's like, oh my God.
Well, have you had one of those moments? A friend of mine famously sat next to a guy at a party and the guy said, I'm in a band. And my friend doing that thing that sometimes you say to someone at a party when they're like, you know, oh, you're in a band, you know, how's your band going? Right? Yeah, that sort of thing. And they're like, he was like, well, my name's Dave Grohl. I'm in the Foo Fighters. And they were like, well, probably pretty good then, I assume. That band you had before that were all right as well. So do you have those moments? Are there moments that the anonymity means that someone like really is surprised by the fact that when you tell them, you know, I'm Vance Joy, you know, that song that you heard in this hairdresser every day for 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote that song.
Yeah. I think, it's probably, and it probably would require me to like say, cause I could say Vance Joy, but to lots of people, like, you know, I mean, you know, they have no idea what I'm talking about. So I'm like Vance Joy and like, you know, so my Uber driver and I'm like, I'm not expecting them. I'm not like expecting them to know me at all, of course. But it's like, I'm in, so Glasgow, and the Uber driver's like, oh, what are you guys doing? It's like, do we say we're just students or do we just like, you know, do we just say we're the band? I'm like, oh, we're playing a show here. And he's like, oh yeah, where are you playing? We're like, oh, we're playing at this place. And he's like, oh, what's the name of the band? It's like Vance Joy. He's like, oh, I think my little sister will know you. Can I get a photo? But it's like, but then he'll be like, do I know your songs? And then I'm like, all right, well, I guess I could sing him like a melody, like the chorus melody of Riptide. But then he might still not know. And I'll just be like, then, fuck. Yeah. You know, like, I can't give you any more than that. There's nothing else I can do besides searching myself and like giving you proof. But
What was your, okay, let's talk about the philosophy and then we can use that as a framework to talk about other things. So do you have one? Is there some sort of, you know, motto or philosophy or perspective you have on, you know, some aspect of your life that you're happy to share with people?
Yeah. I thought when we were talking about that, I thought of, I guess, was thinking of two different philosophies and I don't even know if they're like I try and think of what is something that I like, almost like a mantra that I repeat, and it might not even be. There's two things that I say all the time, and sometimes I think it's just a way of, it's like almost like I just, that's my go-to response. So I feel like someone's always, you know, if someone asks me what's happening, or my dad's like, how's the songwriting going, how's the recording going, I should be like, chipping away. And which I feel like was a good, that was my approach for the last few years, or even for my making my first album, it was just chipping away slowly. And I feel like a lot of my songs and a lot of things happened just really gradually. So I felt like that has been a philosophy for songwriting. And then another philosophy that I felt like, or a mantra that I would say, which I haven't really stuck to as much, or I haven't found myself saying, but I think for a few years, especially early on when I was starting music and I felt like a lot of pressure, you know, and learning how to kind of just how to, like, you know, exist in, like, with, you know, within the framework of having a label and managers and expectations, before making my first album, I would say, often I would say, it is what it is. And that was like my, I think, a way of dealing with pressure and the fact that, you know, sometimes I felt like I was making decisions that were like, you know, I was getting like, you know, pressure. The record label says, we like this song, you need to record that song. You send us a 1 minute voice memo and we like that song. And I'm like, I hate that voice memo. I wish I never sent it. You know, I feel like that sometimes happens. And that happened around the time of my first album. And I was like, cool, it is what it is. Like, I'm just going to, you know, kind of almost like do some things and just push through, even if it's like I might have to do like record something that I wasn't sure about and didn't necessarily know if it was good or not. And it's like, I'm glad I don't know, it's like I kind of accepted some things and just pushed through. And I overcome some stuff, or at least, you know, I never got hung up on anything too long that it really, like, I didn't let it defeat me or, you know, make me feel like derail like things, and I could kind of push through. And
I actually really love that, because I think that is, it's one of those things that I think is a little underrated, which is how quickly you can be derailed by something that doesn't matter. Or how much time you can spend thinking about or worrying about something that perhaps doesn't have anywhere near the consequences that you imagine that thing might have. Yeah. Sometimes it's easier just to do the thing and move on to the other thing that you want to do. You've got to know when to fight those battles, obviously. You've got to know when to say, this is the time where I'm not just going to do that thing, because that's what defines you. But there seems like there's two really separate things going on there, but they're close to each other to me, which is one of them is about the nature of acceptance, right? You know, accept that there are some things that you can't change, or that other people's ideas might be as, you know, relevant as your ideas. But the chipping away thing I love as well, because it speaks to two things for me. And I'll say these things and then I like you to unpack them and, you know, see if I'm anywhere near the point or completely in the opposite direction. It doesn't really matter which. But it feels like two things to me. One is this idea of persistence, right? You know, that a lot of the work is just doing the work. And we spoke this morning on radio, and one of the things that we had a chat about off air was the idea that, you know, off the back of some success that you'd had, you'd gone to America and you were going from radio station to radio station, market to market, you know, sometimes playing in front of, you know, the few sales staff who were in at that time of the morning to hear you play. And that to me spoke of that, right? That to me feels like chipping away.
Yeah.
That's me going in and going, I'm going to build this from the ground up. I'm going to go around and I'm going to do everything that needs to be done to get this done, right? But the second thing that I wanted to speak to was, there's this, it comes up a lot, but it's a Michelangelo quote about the idea that the sculpture is already inside the block. You just have to find which bits to chip away to reveal what it is. So it says two things to me. I like them both, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Now you speak to it, what I'm right about and wrong about.
Well, I feel like they're both right, especially the Michelangelo idea definitely makes sense to me, especially with songwriting, because I feel like you hear songwriters talk about it, like you know, great songwriters like Paul Kelly or Bob Dylan or whoever it is, and they'll say, like, the song already existed. You know, like, I just somehow I got turned onto the right frequency and the song came channeled through me. And I think to be, you know, sometimes you're lucky enough to kind of channel a whole song, you're like, whoa, how did that happen? And I think that's a rare moment. Like, there might be little moments where you channel like a really magic moment, or like even just a couple of lines, or you know, something. But I feel like some really special songs, I'm sure, like, seem to be like a whole miracle that just happened in like a short period of time. So that Michelangelo thing, I feel like it's, that makes sense to me, that it's already pre-existing in its form. And then also with that chipping away idea of like the Michelangelo thing, like it takes, I feel like a lot of the songs that I'm most proud of take so long to finally come about. Like, it's, you know, you write, you have like one line and you have like a melody and you record that into your phone, and it's just like a tiny little seed, and you kind of, you can spend, you know, like you're saying, like you can spend like a whole year like hashing that out, and like, or just repeatedly playing it and being like, okay, have I made any progress on this? Or maybe this isn't a thing. Like, maybe I thought it was good, but, and it's kind of like, I tried to write a song with this melody like 10 times with this guitar. If I, you know, I made like 10 versions of a song with this, and none of them work. And then it might be, and I mean, that's happened to me with songs, a song called Georgia from my first album, and a song from my most recent album called Lay It On Me, where I, especially that, the song Lay It On Me, I had a guitar riff that I wrote in 2012, and I was like, this is a song. Like, I was like, any day now, this is going to be a fully written song here. And then it wasn't until, I wrote various versions, and then it wasn't until the start of 2017, and I went into a songwriting session with a guy in Malibu, and I don't know, it was just like a good moment. Like, I was playing the guitar riff, and he's like, oh, there's something there. And I was like, oh, this thing's dead. Like, there's nothing here. I was like, I'm just filling in time until it's like, we go home. And then, and that's funny how that always happens. Like, sometimes the better ideas are the ones that you're just like, I'm just going to say some stuff now because, you know, there's nothing else happening. And he started to sing a melody over it, and it was like, kind of totally unlocked the song. And there were other ideas that I'd been kind of working on for a while that we kind of glued it together, and it was like, you know, in 1 hour this song that had been totally kind of like, kind of, I guess, just like stagnant, and like it had stalled, and then all of a sudden it kind of just blossomed into a song. And it was like, oh, what a relief. Like, this whole, and it's kind of like a relief of like baggage, because you have like this idea that's kind of weighing on you, and you've kind of been like, oh, like all that time investing hope in that idea, and it's, maybe it won't go anywhere. Which is fine, and it's good to have a waste. I feel like there was a lot of a waste basket filled with songs that never got off the ground. But every now and then it's not, I almost feel like there's ideas like in a storeroom, and it's like you clean out the storeroom, or you clean out that closet with ideas, and it's like, oh, that's out. Like, finally made something out of that. I almost think of it like as like it's like you've got a garage full of trash, and it's like you've got like some weird bicycle spoke with like a stick in it, and it's like, oh, if I put something onto that, it'll somehow make some kind of object that makes sense. So that was my Michelangelo trying to...
I love that. I feel like that fits. How do you know when, if you've got, say you've got this, you know, line that you love, or you've got this, you know, piece of music that you love, or this, you know, one particular, you know, riff or whatever it is that you love, but you haven't found a space for it. How do you know when to stop persisting with trying to find that new space for it and kind of put it back into the cupboard and go, you know what, I'm not going to think about that for a while. I'm going to let that go for a while and move on. Are you good at that? Is that something that you are easy and able to do? Or will you like sit with that going, this should be working, this should be something, and keep trying to unpick it?
I definitely will be like, and I feel like that thing you were saying about the visiting radio stations and that just persistence and like just doing the work, I feel like that almost, it ties in with it, because it's like there's that balance between like, you know, dialing into the frequency, and maybe there's some kind of fluke moment, but it's almost like it's always like that fluke moment. It's like they exist. Maybe they rely on each other, like to have well, that's at least what I'll tell myself, because I will never stop picking away at that idea until it's like frustrating. But I feel like there's that persistent, like trying and trying and trying and trying and trying. I think almost you just keep trying until you kind of almost like feel like you've gone down every dead end, and you're like, oh, I don't know. I feel like that it's almost like you have to. Well, I don't know what you have to do, and I don't know. I read Paul Kelly's memoir, and he talks about like putting the guitar down and like picking it up, and he's got like his fingers are like no longer calloused and his like fingers hurt when he plays. And I'm like, I wish I could be that chill. Maybe you're that chill when you've written all the classic tunes, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, when you've got like, you know, 30 iconic songs under your belt, you're like, you know what? I'll just take a bit of time off the guitar. Something will come to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, how do you deal with that? I reckon what I'd like to do is start where we are now and then we can work backwards if we get to working backwards. Mm. But I'm aware of the fact that, like, you know, if people want to kind of hear about how you got to being here, there are some other places that they can, you know, piece that together. Yeah. What I'd love to talk about first is where you are right now. Like, how do you feel about, you know, yourself, your music, what it is you're trying to do with those sort of things? I mean, you know, how the new album is out now. We're Going Home is the thing, which is you know, when you write one of those, I feel like in 20 years, you know, you can Paul Kelly style, you know, take some time off. Like, I mean, to write a song that is just, I was saying it to everyone in the station this morning, but it's just like a perfect pop song. And I mean that in the way that, like, you know, Paul Kelly writes perfect pop music and Neil Finn writes perfect pop music. It's one of those things that, you know, you can hear in a cafe and at the gym, or as I did the other night when I was walking home from my show, I just put it on repeat as I was walking through the city because it was just a really nice thing to, like, you know, listen to as I was walking through the city of Melbourne. You know, like, have an intimate experience with a song. You know, like, actually listen to the lyrics and try to work out what, you know, it was about to you or what it meant to me and, you know, what I was liking about it. So where are you at with all that? Like, where are you in that process? Like, how long did it take to put together, you know, where you are right now? Like, give me a sense of what your world looks like right now.
Yeah. I guess right now there's a little bit of a breathing moment before... I guess the album came out about a month ago and we did a small European tour, but we really are doing the proper big show, you know, probably a slightly bigger show in terms of scale than we've ever done before in terms of having people that have kind of designed a show with like a proper stage setup. And you know, like the band on rises. I think we actually Jono, our bass player. I know I've mentioned him like three times. I feel like he listens to this, so maybe I've just like subliminally, like, you know, he's told me about it before, so I've just like referenced him a couple of times. But I don't think he ever likes standing on a riser. But he's taking a break on this next run for a few months, so we're definitely gonna get the bass riser in while he's away. So we've got a breather before doing like a bunch of shows. I think it's like 70 shows later this year. And I don't know, actually, when I left the radio station this morning, I was feeling like, oh, I'm like, and it was almost like a little bit of moment of stress, which is kind of doesn't make, it was silly, but I was like, oh, wow. I like, you know, made a second album and I feel really good about the songs. And it's like, I guess you hope that radio stations play your songs, but you don't write them, you know, with like the kind of, you know, you don't intend that, like, you're like, oh, this will sound good on radio. This is what I have to do to have a song on radio, because it's like putting the, you know, it's just the wrong way to go about it. So you just write the songs that come out. But it's nice that, you know, I feel like I've, you know, somehow, you know, you get to that point after chipping away for a couple of years where you've got a body of work. And I was just thinking, oh, I'm glad it didn't kind of, you know, wasn't too much of a distraction, the idea of having to meet, you know, the same level as my first album or having to have a song as, you know, I never really thought, oh, I better have a song as popular as Riptide, because it felt like that's like lightning in a bottle. You can't really just make that happen. So I don't know. I was just thinking, oh, wow, that kind of somehow, I just had a moment of thinking, oh, wow, it's nice to have just to be on the other side of that. And then to just be at the start of this process of, I guess, you know, playing the new album, kind of promoting it. But I was also just like, oh, wow, that kind of just happened. Like, it's almost like I was coming up for air or something, that kind of idea.
Well, that's interesting to me, because I can imagine that even if you never had that thought, that plenty of other people had that thought.
Yeah. Right?
You know, plenty of other people were like, you know, because of the success of Riptide, like you said, it's one of those things where it was a song that was not only, you know, just a perfect, you know, song in the way that it was, but it was perfect for the time that it, you know, all those things that, you know, are needed for something to sort of, you know, become what that song became all came together at once. And you'd be absolutely crazy to think that you could ever do that again. But what you want to do is do something that you feel is equal to that. That isn't the only thing that anyone's ever going to. Yeah. And I'm sure there are a million other people who are sitting around, you know, at the record company going, fuck, I hope he writes another Riptide.
Yeah, I know. Oh, but that's not even, you don't even have to change any words in that sentence. That's exactly it.
So how is it that you managed to avoid that in your world and your brain? Like how did you, like, what was your process like? You know, how long did it take you to kind of put together the album? When did you know that, like, I think this is done? You know, because the other thing you could do is become, you know, Guns N' Roses, Chinese Democracy, and, you know, just work on the album for 10 years or 12 years to try to get it perfect, you know? Yeah. How do you know when you're going, no, I think this is what, this is done. How long does that process take, and what does it feel like when you go, no, I think this is it. I think it's time to record this and put this out to people.
Yeah. With the idea of, like, Riptide and trying to, I guess, what would be the next step after that? I think I was actually in a songwriting session with a guy named Dan Wilson, who's a really awesome songwriter, and he was in a band called Semisonic
that had
Closing Time, and he's written a bunch of amazing songs, and he is, like, you know, he writes songs mostly, and he still writes his own stuff for himself, and he's an awesome dude. And he was like, you know, when people would ask him to, like, write that song again or whatever other song again, he'd be like, I can do anything else but that exact thing. Like, and I feel like that with, like, Riptide, it's like, I can do something else. It's like, and I guess that's what's exciting about songwriting, is that you can explore other things and you can find something that is exciting to you and explore it. And maybe if you follow that instinct, you can find some fresh idea that is there. So for me, it was just, you know, following the instinct, and also just, you know, it's like, there's a feeling you might get when you write a song that's like, oh, that, for whatever reason, it's like that there's something there. There's something that is, like, interesting me and is holding me and kind of keeping me interested. And, you know, you might get, you know, people talk about getting chills when they play, and that doesn't always happen, but sometimes you might get, like, a chill when you play, or you might, it just, for whatever reason, there's a connection that you're like, okay, this has that quality. It might not have it in, like, steroid level, which is, like, some songs might just have that. It's like, if you write the most classic song ever, it's like, far out, that's got steroid level flavor. But some songs, well, every song, I feel like, to meet the criteria of being, like, worthwhile or making sense, it has some little bit of that. So I usually just follow that instinct and feel like, I don't know, it's not even something that's really measurable. It's just like a feeling. But I feel like having enough of making songs that meet that criteria, and then just trying to just do it over and over again, and trying to build as many of those songs up and put them, you know, kind of like put them around, like, a song like Riptide, so that people who do want to, like, and a lot of people won't, like, even when I listen to, like, songs on, like, Spotify, I'm just like, just, like, play, like, the banger, and then the next song comes on, I'm just like, catch you later. Like, I'm like, I'm like the guy that I don't want to be, but I can't help
I would say this, though, as a bit of a tip to any artists out there, because I know people used to put their albums together, like, I want this song to go into this song, and, you know, the idea of an entire album. I would now say, if you've got a banging single, put whatever you think your next best song is, the one after that, Spotify, because if I've moved away from my computer or whatever, I'll get into the second half. So one of my favorite songs to listen to before a stand-up show, for whatever reason, is Chandelier by Sia.
Oh,
I just, Clear, yeah. There's just something about that, like, song that I just, is a perfect song to listen to before I go on stage. But the next song is a song called Cheap Thrills on the Spotify, which I had never really been that familiar with and now know very well. And then the other day when it rolled on in, I was like, you know what, I'm going to listen to Cheap Thrills as well. This is not a bad song either.
I love those two songs. But yeah, I mean, like, that's like the just the most bangerest banger ever. So that's exactly the way you need to, like, put your album together.
So here's what I wanted to ask you. You've mentioned a couple of times already talking about working with other people writing songs. You tour with a band. It's a show. I mean, like, technically, you could, you know, put some cymbals between your knees and do the whole thing yourself, you know.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's something in you that enjoys the idea of collaboration as being part of your process. So talk to me about collaboration and what you get out of that and where that comes from.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I was in a band after high school, we were called Hypersonic, and we played a few gigs. We played at the Swan on a Tuesday night.
what sort of music was Hypersonic?
Hypersonic played a lot of music that sounded exactly like Block Party, because right. It was like 2006, and okay.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah. It was just almost like exactly like it was like too close.
Right.
Like, but
so only person who really could have done with the music was Block Party.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It was, yes, it was, but it was good. It was a good learning curve for collaborating. And there was a song we wrote called Disco, which when I think I'm totally biased and also nostalgic about the moment we wrote that, but we were just at my friend Andre's house in his, you know, the room where we would just kind of like jam out. And he was playing a bass riff, and you know, my friend Will, who doesn't play drums, he plays a little bit of drums now, but he's like not doing music. He was like, "Oh, maybe play the riff, like go to the next note higher." And then I was like, "Oh," and then Liam, the guitar, was like, "Go to the next note." And it was like, it was just a nice moment of everyone just like throwing in ideas about how he should make his next move. And as a result, the chord progression was like so different to something I would play, because even now I feel like my chord progressions are like more typical like pop songs where it's like four chords, and they're kind of like really like those progressions that feel right. And like I feel like when I first heard, you know, a four chord progression, even if it's like E minor, C, G, D, just feels so good. And I was like, this feels like a song, like this feels like it's got a journey in that progression that's like resolves beautifully. And it's like I feel like a lot of my songs, it's almost like if you take away all the other elements, it's like, oh, that's like those chords. And it's obviously like, to make it a good song, it has to have so many other things that are like, you know, making it more complex or whatever. But yeah, so we made a riff that was like totally unique, and then I started singing over it, and we made this kind of cool song that even now I'm like, oh, that's cool. And it was like we were all doing something more than just ourselves. And I feel like when I've had good experiences collaborating, especially in terms of songwriting, it's like oh, like you sang that melody and it's like totally just unlocked the song for me. And with a producer, it's the same thing with a good producer. They'll play like a little piano line. Like when I first went to a studio in Seattle and worked with a guy called Ryan Hadlock, he just has like a certain, like he just got a little keyboard and started playing a line. And it kind of, I was like, that's like the best thing ever. Like this song was like, I was like, oh, this is a good song. I felt like it was like made sense, but that line, it just like raised the song to another level. And I was like, oh, you're a magic guy, like you've added this special thing. And even and I always will want to go back to working with him, because, and we did a few more songs with him on this album, because it's like his strength is like some weird, you know, it's like he just added some vibey little keyboard, and it was like, yeah. So I love that. And it's like I think that those rare moments when you do have a collaboration where you totally get some awesome connection, or someone adds a flavor that you never anticipated and it raises the song, it makes it like way better than it was. I think that's like awesome. So the songwriting and production, and my drummer Ed kind of will do that, and he'll dress the songs up, you know, so much better than I, you know, could have envisaged. And if I was left alone with a producer and they're like, you know, I feel like we would, without Ed's percussion and his rhythm and his whole approach to rhythm, I think like it's such a big part of what people probably associate with what sounds like, you know, my music. And it's like, it's not just like my guitar playing and my voice. It's probably some cool rhythm that he does. It's quite subtle maybe. And it's probably it's not necessarily grabbing your attention and pulling your focus, but it's like, yeah, it's a big part of it.
A lot of people, when people can't see the work that others are doing, are hesitant to give people credit for that work. You know, I'm certainly of the belief that you don't lose anything by giving people the proper credit for what they do. Mm. But is that something that you've always, it seems to come quite naturally to you. Mm. Like, you know, there's no pretense with you to say, you know, I wrote with these other people, or that, you know, Ed, you know, contributes this much that you probably associate with, you know, something I'm getting a pat on the back for. Mm. These are things that you tend to offer without me prying about them. Mm. Is that something that you've always... Mm. You know, done? Are you always a person who's kind of given everyone credit, or is that something that you've developed as you've, you know, kind of moved through this? Do you have a sense of that? I mean, it may not even be something that, you know, anyone said to you before, but.
No, I think there was initially, like, even with a song like Lay It On Me, it was a song that I co-wrote. And I think initially it was like, you know, it was like, do we, you know, when I'm talking about it, do I say that I wrote the song with someone else? And it's like, yeah, it's funny because like, it's easier as well just to be honest and be like, well, I wrote this song with Dave. And as I have a better story that way. It's like, I don't have to, you know, tread this line where I'm kind of like, oh, I had this guitar riff and then magically then I had this song. And it's like, I don't, it was like, that's a hard thing.
Yada, yada, yada.
Yada, yada, yada. It's like, there's no story there, but at least with him, it's like, I actually did have a really good connection with him. Like I went into the studio with him in Malibu and he was like, you know, he'd say a few things, and it's actually scary in a songwriting session to kind of step out into the unknown part, because you can just be like, oh, cool, he's playing a riff, I'll just sing whatever, and like we don't have to push it. Maybe we don't say, oh, I don't really like what you're playing, but it's like sometimes I feel like when you say, oh, actually, I'm not sure if I'm into that. Even if it's sometimes scary to say something that feels like confrontational like that, and it depends. My personality is kind of like, I don't want to like offend anyone, so it's like that when you do say that, oh, let's try something else, it's like it breaks down the barrier and it's like maybe we're communicating more directly. And I think that's what happened between us, me and Dave Bassett. It was like, he's like, cool, like no egos, you know, like that. And it was a really important stepping stone towards getting to those two songs that we wrote together in a couple of days. And so, yeah, I'm like far out. Like he's such a big part of those songs. And then we had such a good connection that he ended up producing about six songs on the album. So I think... it's easier just to give him the credit he deserves, and I also want to work with him again. So.
Well, he's a big listener to the podcast, so yeah, I'll appreciate shout out.
Yeah.
So I always think of, in my job, you know, there's two really, I'm currently doing the Melbourne Comedy Festival, so and I always talk to people about the idea that I'm, right about now I'm like 15, 16 shows into the new tour, which means that the show is pretty much starting to feel like it's going to be pretty much the same as this. Up until this point, it's still been a process of creation. Mm-hmm. And from now on, it will be a bit more a process of recreation, right? And so you as an artist, you've gone through, you know, these couple of years of creating, you know, obviously you're still playing and stuff at the same time, but you've created these new songs and you have this new album and now you're going to move into this like period of time where it's not about, you know, writing songs or constructing songs. It's about, you know, taking those songs out and then performing those songs, which is the same job as you were doing before, but a completely different skill set of things that it takes to do that job. And with that comes the idea that you're going to be out doing interviews and doing promotion. Again, a thing that people probably don't think about as being part of your creative process, but it's part of the process of getting people to listen to the music and you know, come and see your shows. So do you see that? Do you notice that? And is there one of those states that you prefer more, or is it the fact that all of those things are part of the process? Like, I mean, I can imagine there's some people who only who write songs now, but don't perform because they love writing songs, but they don't really like performing songs. There's some people who probably don't like writing songs, but love, you know, performing. There's an outlet for that sort of music as well. And then there's what you are, which is you're, you know, constructing it, but also then performing it. So I just, tell us a little bit about the difference between those two things and what you like about them and what you don't, you know?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, and I think, you know, I guess when you even like to go back to Sia, it's like, I think she, you know, what I'm kind of a fan of hers. I watched interviews with her maybe just before she kind of stopped doing press, and maybe before her, she had like so many absolutely incredibly amazing pop bangers that it's like, she kind of almost like kind of redefined what she wanted to do. And like, she doesn't have to do, maybe she does it in a different way, but it's like totally unique approach to promotion and stuff, which is, she's awesome. But for me, it has been a lot of, it's like the season, it's like different seasons. It's like season of writing and then a season of like, almost like the well is kind of empty, or it feels like it is. Maybe you're just telling yourself it is, but, and you're doing those, all that promotion. And I feel like when I'm playing shows and you're playing the same set repeatedly, I like to look in the crowd and like look at people's faces and like try and like look in people's eyes every now and then without being too creepy. So I don't know exactly what the right approach is, because I feel like maybe if I'm just like play the song and smile, like does the crowd know the difference? Does the crowd know the difference between like a real smile, like I'm really happy and smiling and looking in someone, or do they know maybe if I just look like into the exit sign and smile, like is the person in the crowd having, you know, does, I don't have any control maybe over what they're experiencing. So I don't know. It's, I guess when you, those are the kind of thoughts you might have after like playing the same show 50 times and you're like, maybe I'm just like, maybe it doesn't matter. Like maybe I'll just, you know, and that sounded like a, it sounds like negative or something, but I think your mind just trails like that. And it's nice. Every now and then there's a moment where, you know, maybe someone yells something out, or maybe you just say a different story, or you're tired and you start talking between songs in a different way, and it's the unrehearsed way, and it totally just like pours like a fresh bunch of water over, it rejuvenates the whole set, and everyone's kind of like in the moment because something unscripted happens. So I think, I guess those moments will happen, and it's like those are the ones that make the shows sometimes stick out and make them more memorable than the other shows. And I guess for the crowd, you hope that they're like, you know, that it's like the same for them every time. I don't know, but you can definitely, I'm sure it's like, it is that thing of recreation. It's like, it, you want it to be that authentic moment of like, this is a genuine smile and like, I am laughing with joy now. And you know, it's like, I guess you can't make it happen every time. But yeah, so I guess I got a bit, well, yeah.
Well, no, that's nice. I like that. That's what I am interested in. How do you deal with the actual practicalities of your job? Because one part of it, I imagine you can do, you know, staying in the same place, like the writing, you know, you go, I'm going to go and live here for, you know, this amount of time, and I'm going to write with this person, or I'm going to, you know, like set up at home and I'm going to, you know, do that. Whereas once you start touring the thing, suddenly you're living out of a suitcase, you're on the road. Like, do you enjoy that aspect of it? How are you as a traveler, as a...
Yeah, I feel like I've been traveling, like even when I was making the album, I was like staying at Airbnbs for a week or two and then going to songwriting sessions, and it was always just like pretty like, you know, a suitcase life, and it was pretty, you know, transient or whatever. And so I, even now it's like, I feel like I didn't have that setting up really a home base, and there wasn't like a sense of like, hey, I'm moving to London and I'm like going to be living in London now. Or it's like, hey, I'm moving to New York. It was like, there was no official... like, you know, like setting up or doing something kind of like that, which I've seen other friends do and even other musicians do, like we're setting up home base. It was like, there was never any of that. It was kind of like, I'm going to go stay at my parents' house for 2 weeks, and then I'm going to stay in an Airbnb in Seattle for 2 weeks. And then I think I'm just going to be back at my parents' for 2 weeks. And it's like, that's the kind of story that isn't as exciting, when people are like, oh, so like, what kind of deep love did you find in between your two albums? And I feel like often, and I think even my friends will be like, where did you write this song? Like, you don't even have a girlfriend. And I'll be like, oh, well, I live in the world, and like, I live in the world. I have had girlfriends in the past. I read books. I watch movies. I watched a movie on the plane that I found really inspiring. It's like, that's kind of, I guess that's the unromantic or the unglamorous stuff. But I feel like a lot of that stuff, like living out of a suitcase, and which I've probably gotten pretty used to, and to the point where my suitcase is like, I opened it up and my dad's like, wow, it's pretty neat, like you have like a few different bags there for like dirty stuff and stuff's folded. And I'm like, I know I wasn't always like this, but
this is my whole house
this is my whole house, dad. And I'll be like, wait, don't touch that, that sock has to fold just so. And it's like, I catch myself doing that, like folding like a sock, and then I was like, or folding a jumper, and then I look at it and there's like a drawstring that's in, and I'm like, I feel like that's when I'm like, tell myself that I need to like do something different. Maybe. And then I'm like, you should definitely get on a dating app, mate. But yeah, I also feel like, yeah, I can't always give, like, especially when friends or people who listen to my songs are like, you must have experienced some kind of life-altering moments in between those two albums. And it's like, not really life-altering. Like, you know, I definitely was like inspired by music and always listening to music and like, you know, inspired by things that I read and reflection on like memories and experiences and things that I hear. But it's almost like in that, if you're doing that, it's like you're observing, you're not necessarily like being fully engaged in like, when I've been in relationships that are like super overwhelming and like head over heels stuff, it's like, I don't think I was writing any songs that I was writing then were just like almost, you know, a product of like that, you know, giddiness, but they weren't like, there's nothing like substantial that I think I wrote during those periods.
Do you write a song for a girlfriend and play her the song? Have you been that guy?
No, I haven't been that guy. And I say yet because I've read, you know, I wrote a song on this most recent album that was like a memory that was kind of very much just a childhood memory of when I fell off my bike. And then it kind of tells a little story about, you know, my family. And I was like, I don't do that. I don't like write autobiographical song. Like, I thought that was like, you know, weird. Like, I thought that was something that I didn't do just because I hadn't done it yet. And so it was like, oh, well, that door's open now. So I think maybe I will write a song about a girlfriend. And then I was watching the George Harrison documentary, and in it, George Harrison's ex-wife talks about when Eric Clapton claimed to write Layla for her.
Yeah.
And he played it for her. And she's like, what could I do? It's the most beautiful song. And like, it was overwhelming to have this song written for me. And I can't imagine like being, I don't know, maybe if I was head over heels and also like I really knew someone well and I was like, and I actually did write the song for them, I would be like, sit down, I want to play you a song. But if I did it now, it'd be like, hey, we met last week. I wrote this song for you. I wrote this song for you 2 years ago. And it would just be like disingenuous. So I can't see a situation when I could actually do that. But maybe I'll do it.
Maybe you just have to take them to the beach a lot, get them caught in a riptide, yeah. And then backdate the whole story. And
backdate
just
go, it. I'd be like, have you heard this song? And they'll be like, where do you live?
So love, is that an important thing to you? Is it something that like is on your mind in a general sense? Like, you know, like, you know, the idea that you have love to give to another person, or that, you know, you have stuff that you want to share with somebody else?
Yeah, I think seeing a lot of friends now, because I just turned 30, and a lot of my friends are probably, I feel like some of that sense, like I feel like when I was 24, 25, there was more of a sense of like, oh, I've got to hang out with my mates. I've got to go to Meredith. And like the world revolves around going to Meredith with my mates. And then it's funny how like that certainty of like, and that sense of like how solid that friendship group is. And it is solid, but it's also like, you know, in the last couple of years, everyone's kind of, you know, some of my mates who have, and it's been awesome seeing them like in committed relationships and seeing like, you know, and everyone's kind of, you know, priorities have changed a bit, and it's like, oh yeah, like yeah, like I guess Meredith, but like cool, but like I also want to go home like after one night, like not in a bad way. Yeah. maybe I'll stick around, but it's also, I think it was just seeing that and also feeling like, oh, it'd be cool. And from knowing what it's like to have, you know, a partner in crime, knowing that how good that is, like, and to be at Meredith, but not as like a lone wolf kind of like, you know, like, you know, like whatever.
I think we all know. Yeah, I don't think you have to say it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to be there with someone and be like, oh, like, let's just go to bed, or let's do something else. Let's get away. And so it's, I think having that person there is a nice way to give you kind of, I don't know what it is. It's almost like you kind of can, it just gives you like, what am I trying to think of? It's like, it's just that the ability to kind of like to go away, but you fill in those empty moments, those moments that would spend like hotel room alone or like night alone. It's kind of like when you're single, you fill in those moments. You're kind of like, oh, 4 hours, what do I do now? Like, I got to go fill up that space. Whereas when I was in, you know, a long-term relationship, it was like, oh yeah, like we watch like
have a cup of tea and watch 8 episodes of a Netflix show.
yeah. It's like, and then all that time would have just sailed by without me even thinking about how to, you know, occupy that space. Right. And I feel like being on tour, you're constantly marking time before soundcheck, before the show. You're like, okay, I'll go to the gym, or, you know, just whatever it is. And then it's funny, coming off the road, which should be holiday time, it's sometimes, you know, actually it's almost like the opposite of singles, like freedom, but I think maybe there's more freedom having someone that's like, allows you just to be like, oh, we don't have to go anywhere. You don't, there's no stress to like fill up this time. It's like 8 episodes of show, you know, How I Met Your Mother. Let's watch that. You know, it's like,
and it's fine because you're doing it with somebody.
Doing it
by yourself, you're like, oh, my life's really sad.
Yeah, exactly. Man, I watched so many episodes of The Office, like at my Airbnb in LA. It's like, oh, this is a nice Airbnb. Oh, this is a nice dinner I just ordered myself. Oh, how funny is Steve Carell? And laughing, and I'm just like,
No.
Yeah, I needed someone to like totally put some perspective on it all.
Okay, so we have to start finishing up because, you have to leave and I have a show to do, so we probably need to do that.
Massive day for you.
I'm so glad that we could squeeze this in there because I know you're about to leave the country and not come back until September.
Yeah.
You're doing shows. I know you're doing Melbourne. You're playing Rod Laver Arena and they've just put on another show. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
So another Rod Laver Arena?
Yeah.
So that's interesting to me. So Rod Laver Arena, for those who are overseas, is like a very big venue. And it's, Melbourne's your hometown, right? Mm. So playing, Rod Laver Arena, which is as big as it gets in Melbourne. Mm. When you decide to book Rod Laver Arena, I guess that, everyone's hopeful that you're going to sell enough tickets to sell out Rod Laver Arena.
Mm.
But there's got to be a bit of you goes, we might not sell them all. We might, get close enough.
Yeah,
if we get this many people at Rod Laver Arena, it's still going to be a good night.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly,
So you have that thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it sells out. Mm. And then someone comes along and goes, we're going to put on a second show.
Yeah.
Now, it's okay to put on a second show if you're at the corner because you can sell another 300.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you're literally starting again with a whole other Rod Laver Arena.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's good. And obviously, I think you obviously know this. At this, the whole idea of this, shows and selling them out, and so that it's exactly basically the way that it goes down, and you're kind of like, it's like, oh, is that a bit ambitious, like Rod Laver, and in not in a way that's like trying to be too humble or something. It's like you're just like, okay, like cool, and then you're kind of like, okay, does everyone think this is a valid thing? And obviously, everyone knows what they're talking about and doing, so you're like, okay, cool, and then when the tickets were so, the response was so strong, it's like, oh, amazing. And then that conversation happened where my managers were like, so we're considering another one. And I'm like, oh, okay. So like, we're not going to go to a slightly smaller venue or whatever. And they're like, they're like, obviously you've got curtains at Rod Laver, so you can black out areas. So you can make Rod Laver Arena as big or small as you want it to be, which apparently is true. I think people still know they're in an arena, even if like we've curtained off like half of it. So we'll see how much curtains we need. I'm like, get more curtains. But that was the thing. And the philosophy was like, if there are people that still want tickets, like make it available. And it's like, cool. Like, it's like you won't be touring for a while after this. So it's like, if it's like 6,000 people in Rod Laver Arena, get some curtains, but it'll be enough to create to make a proper show there. And it's like, there might be 7,000. It's like, well, that's maybe slightly too big for another venue. So just do it.
So the interesting thing about that to me is just your thought process in that, because there's got to be a moment where you go, dudes, we've sold out Rod Laver Arena. Can we not just be happy with the fact that we're going to do a sold out show at Rod Laver Arena? Mm. Unless the second one sells out, which let's hope it does, right? That's why you put it on. You put it on in the hope that the first one sold so quickly that it shows that there's a demand that hopefully you sell out the other one. Mm. But there's also that other bit of your brain that goes, no, that was the exact amount of people
that was the right
who
amount.
Wanted to see me. We literally had booked the exact right venue and we haven't moved another ticket since.
I know.
Do you then go, you know what, fuck it. I'm not going to take the easy option here, which is to go, no, we did it. Let's just lock this in and sell like this. Let's roll the dice and see what we're capable of here. How does that thought process come about in your mind?
Yeah. Well, I guess this probably is a reflection on the way I operate. It's like, I think I probably have a little bit more involvement in like, or at least I stay atop like how sales are going. And sometimes I regret, I'm like, ask Rachel, my manager, like, could you send me like how the ticket sales are going? And like, almost, I don't even want to know sometimes, like, I don't necessarily want to know that there's only 400 tickets sold in Reno. Cause like, I just don't need that in my brain. You know, like I feel like we'll just get there on the night and it's like, it'll feel full. That's fine. And like, I guess you want it to feel full. So if that's that, great. So sometimes I don't like to have too many statistics in my head. And I guess as an extension of that, when it comes to the second Rod Laver, it's like, I defer so often to like my managers, our booking agent and stuff. So it's like, I feel like there's a lot of decisions. It's like dilly dallying. But in my head, I know I'm just gonna go with like what they say. Like not always, but for stuff like the business stuff and people who know what they're doing. Like
Well, here's what I'm going to ask you then based on that. All right. People hear this podcast. You know, you've been doing the rounds. The album's going really well. Second show's on sale. It sells out. And there's a couple of months to go and they come to you and they say, James, we'd like to do a third run.
I'll be like, I'd put the big X on that and I would say, no. I'll be like, you're crazy. I'll be like, that is unfathomable. That situation. And it's not going to happen. But yeah, if it did, I think, you know, it's crazy. It's hard to say no to like those people. Like, but yeah, I don't know. Like,
who are your, I mean, obviously to sell that many tickets, you know, your fans are everyone. But who do you find it is who is most strongly, you know, kind of responding to your music?
I think when if I play a show, like I played a show in New Zealand recently, it was like my first headline show. It was in a small kind of room, maybe about 200 people. And in that front few rows, it's usually like kind of women, girls, like probably aged. I feel like there was some like teenagers in there, like mostly teenagers, like in the front few rows. But then there's also a lot of couples. Like I feel there's a lot of young couples. And when I do meet and greets after shows, it's like, I feel like there's a lot of couples. Young people, and then families, like, and sometimes little kids with their parents. And then, yeah, like people with their parents actually as well, like a dad with his daughter or, you know, a mum. And it's kind of like, there's a bit of that, but I feel like it's probably, I know that Rach and Jad and my managers would have the exact, no, they'd be like Facebook reacts activity between 19 to 24 year old women. That's like, it gets that precise. So, but I think it's women probably 19 to 26.
The interesting thing though is like something you said then, which I think is true. I mean, I've just been working at the radio station you came into this morning only for a couple of months, you know. But I've never seen a wider demographic of people being interested in one of the artists we've had into play. And we've had a lot of great artists in already to play, but it feels like your music, you know, really across the board, you know, kind of appeals to people. But a second thing is something you notice there, which is like, parents with their kids, you know, couples there together, it's something that they can share with each other. And I think that's a remarkably cool thing.
Yeah.
Like it feels like something that, you know, like you said, that idea of like, yeah, watching, you know, how I Met Your Mother by yourself is sad, but, you know, being able to, you know, share those jokes together makes it kind of something special. And then you become a part of a bond that, you know, a father has with a daughter or a couple have together. I mean, admittedly, then when they break up, only one of them gets to be a fan of yours and keeps all the records and stuff. But, all right, I always ask this question and we need to finish up, so I'm going to ask it for you now, which is, do you have any idea about, you don't have to have an idea about this. Is death a thing that is present in your mind? Do you think about death and do you think about what happens after we die? Do you have, are you a like, you know, practical person when it comes to that? Do you have some sort of bigger belief in the nature of, you know, life? You know, I just like to hear what people say.
Yeah. I think I probably will have a different perspective of it. If especially if someone really close to me, you know, dies, I think I might have a different idea. Maybe, but I don't know. I think that, I'm trying to think of what Alan Watts would say. I like to listen to him talk about stuff. And I feel like, I don't know. Like my feeling is just like, I believe in like energy and that kind of thing. But I think that maybe, when it's done, it's done. And I feel like I've only come to kind of think about it a little bit more cause my parents are getting a bit older and I'm like, I might see an old person. I'm like, oh man, like my parents are getting older now. And so I feel as well like I want to just kind of like, you know, not feel like I'm holding on to, like not being too frugal or whatever it is with anything because it's like, you know, it's so silly. Like even any negativity, it's so dumb when you think about the fact that you're only here for such a short amount of time. It's like you hear someone that says like a snide comment or someone says something like bitchy or boasts and it's like, man, like that's so weird that we did. Why do we even get caught up in that? Because it's like we are just like here for like, you know, 2 seconds. So I don't know. I think about that maybe less about, you know, what happens after, but just more about, you know, this, I don't know, the finality of it and how quick it's over.
Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad that you made the time. I really appreciate it sincerely. The album is out. Tell me what the name of the album is again. I'll do a proper plug at the start all the information. But, you know, people have listened this long. They get to hear the plug at the end as well.
The album is Nation of Two.
And, of course, you are touring all over the world, basically, at the moment. So people can catch you in the US, in Australia. Is there European dates as well?
European dates as well.
So you're going to be on the road. So plenty of people listening to this all over the world. So, if you're coming to that part, I imagine in the UK, there's you get that mix of like people who know your music independently, but also that... You know, expat Australian.
You get the odd Aussie, and you're just like, you don't know what. I'm sure you get that as well, and you're just like, you just like look down or something.
I've not only got it, but I've been it. Because there is that thing about, you know, being overseas. I mean, I remember seeing Paul Kelly in Edinburgh in the Spiegel tent in 1999, and I remember going, I almost would have yelled out Aussie, Aussie, Aussie that night. I was like, it felt like you were part of something special. Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for doing the show.
Thank you.